From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
In 1988, Tom DeLay's father had a tragic accident in their backyard, and Tom DeLay and his family, like millions of other families in the United States, decided to pull life support from their father.
House Majority Leader Tom DeLay led the congressional charge against pulling Terri Schiavo's feeding tube, but he made a similar decision 17 years ago. The polls show the overwhelming majority of Americans are opposed to congressional and presidential intervention in the Schiavo case. We'll also look at another of the issues that has caused the plunge in President Bush's popularity: the privatization of Social Security. We'll hear a debate.
This isn't a popular reform when it's explained in a complete and straightforward way, and that's why it's, at the moment at least, on life support.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As many as 2,000 people have died in Indonesia after a massive earthquake hit the region Monday. The quake occurred near the epicenter of December's earthquake that triggered the devastating tsunami that killed 280,000 people across 11 countries. Monday's earthquake registered at a magnitude of 8.7. The epicenter was near the Indonesian island of Sumatra. This is Jan Eglin, the Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations.
The hard-hit population of western Sumatra have been again struck by a very large earthquake. This is not an aftershock. It is one of those earthquakes you call a great earthquake because it's between 8 and 9 on the Richter's scale. It has created a lot of panic in Sumatra. All over the island, it was very, very easy to feel how big it was. We do not have reports of any tsunami yet anywhere, and we have also only limited reports of damage.
Officials believe the worst-hit area was the Indonesian island of Nias, where hundreds of buildings have been destroyed. While no tsunami resulted from the earthquake, a series of warnings were issued for the Indian Ocean region. The U.S.-run Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii warned that all coastal areas within 600 miles of the epicenter be evacuated without delay. The warnings were withdrawn after no giant waves appeared. In Aceh, tens of thousands of people abandoned their tents and temporary homes in fear. The area was devastated by the December 26 tsunami. As many as 100 aftershocks have shook the region since December. But Monday's earthquake was by far the strongest. A group of former U.S. diplomats are publicly calling for the Senate to reject John Bolton's nomination to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. 59 former diplomats have signed an open letter outlining their views to Senator Richard Lugar. Lugar's the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which will hold the hearings on Bolton's nomination April 7th. Bolton has been one of the fiercest critics of the United Nations within the Bush administration. In 1994, Bolton said, quote, "If the UN Secretariat building in New York lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference." He has also called for the U.S. to stop paying dues to the UN. In Iraq, the nation's new parliament is meeting today for only the second time since elections were held 2 months ago. The Shiite majority is still trying to form a coalition government with the Kurds. The media was banned from covering today's assembly, in part because reporters have criticized the politicians for delaying the formation of a government. Meanwhile, Iraq's interior minister warned citizens Monday to not hold any public protests, saying they were an invitation for large-scale attack. The warning comes a day after government bodyguards opened fire on a group of government employees demanding a pay raise. At least one protester died in the shooting. A 23-year-old Army mechanic has been sentenced to 7 months in jail for refusing to carry out his duties. Specialist Blake Lemoyne spent a year in Iraq, but has since condemned the invasion and occupation. He once said, quote, "Iraqi civilians are often treated worse than animals." After a year in Iraq, Blake Lemoyne returned to Germany last May. He then started refusing to perform duties, citing religious reasons.
I did volunteer, and I do agree with the principle that a country has the right to wage war if it is a justified and wise war. I do believe that. I support the United States' right to go to war. However, should someone decide that they do not wish to help, they should be able to quit.
That was Blake Lemoyne. Newly released FBI documents provide new evidence that the agency helped a group of Saudis leave the United States days after the September 11th attacks. The documents show the FBI gave personal airport escorts to two prominent Saudi families who fled the United States. A total of 160 Saudis, including members of Osama bin Laden's family, left in the week after the attacks. According to the New York Times, the FBI documents left open the possibility that some departing Saudis had information relevant to the September 11th investigation, but were never questioned. 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11th were from Saudi Arabia. One FBI memo from 2003 read, quote, "Although the FBI took all possible steps to prevent any individuals who were involved in or had knowledge of the attacks from leaving the U.S. before they could be interviewed, it is not possible to state conclusively that no such individuals left the U.S. without FBI knowledge." In Minnesota, federal officials have arrested a youth in connection with last week's shootings that left 10 dead at the Red Lake Native American Reservation. Until now, investigators have said the shooter, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss, acted alone. Weiss killed himself on the day of the rampage. Police have not said what role the arrested youth had in the killings. The New York Times identifies the young man as Luis Jourdain, the teenage son of the Red Lake Chippewas tribal leader Floyd Jourdain Jr. In Colorado, the state Supreme Court has vacated the death sentence of a man convicted for rape and murder because jurors consulted the Bible during deliberations. The court ruled that jurors are not allowed to consider outside material that has not been admitted into evidence, let alone use such material to convince other jurors to convict. During deliberations, members of the jury had studied biblical verses such as eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. One of the closest allies of the Bush family, James Baker, has been named to co-chair a private bipartisan commission to investigate the federal election system. Baker served as Secretary of State under the first President Bush. He later served as chief legal advisor to George W. Bush during the 2000 election campaign and oversaw the contested Florida recount. Baker will co-chair the commission with former President Jimmy Carter. And the magazine Advertising Age is reporting McDonald's is hoping to gain some street cred and increase sales by reaching to the hip-hop generation. The restaurant chain is offering to pay big-name hip-hop artists if they include references to Big Macs in their rhymes. The fast food company is reportedly willing to pay rappers up to $5 each time songs with the plug are played on the radio. McDonald's has hired the same marketing firm that successfully got five hip-hop artists to name drop Seagram's Gin last year in their songs.
Attracted to things that'll bring the trauma. Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate, and when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate, and that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
People
y'all.
Killing, people dying, children hurt, and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach? turn the other cheek. Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
Where is the love? Where is the love?
Where is the love?
It just ain't the same. Always new change. New days are strange. Is the world insane? If love and peace is so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering as the youth are young. So ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends. Not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know.
Where is the Love by the Black Eyed Peas here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. According to a USA Today CNN Gallup poll released last week, President Bush's approval rating has fallen to 45%, the lowest point in his presidency. The poll found the largest drop for Bush came among men, self-described conservatives and churchgoers. Independent political analysts said the drop may reflect opposition to the White House and Congress intervening in the Terri Schiavo matter. A CBS poll released over the weekend showed 82% of Americans thought Congress should have stayed out of the Schiavo case, and three-quarters said government should keep out of end-of-life issues. One of the most outspoken voices in the Congress over the past 2 weeks on this issue is House Majority Leader Tom DeLay.
To friends, family, and millions of people praying around the world this Palm Sunday weekend, don't be afraid. Terri Schiavo will not be forsaken.
House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who's been one of the most outspoken opponents of removing Terri Schiavo's feeding tube. But 17 years ago, DeLay and his family had to make a similar decision over his own comatose father. They elected not to keep him alive by artificial means. We're joined on the phone right now by Walter Roach, one of the two Los Angeles Times reporters who broke the story. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Tell us what you learned. Tell us exactly what happened 17 years ago.
What happened was the congressman's father, he had just been elected to his third term then. They were tinkerers. They had built a tram railroad car to take them down from his lake house in Texas down to the lake below, which was like a 200-foot drop. And they were trying it out for the first time. One of the brothers, the father, had just gone and gotten a new part for the rail car, part of the braking mechanism. And when the two brothers and their wives got in the car, it suddenly started flying down the tracks out of control. He apparently continually tried to apply the brakes, and it didn't work. And they went slamming off the track into some rocks, and the father was thrown into a tree and suffered severe injuries to the right side of his body, his head and his chest. He had broken ribs. He had internal brain damage. He was kept alive for about 27 days. He was on a respirator, and the doctors had told the family, according to the people that Sam Verhoek and I talked to, that if he did live, he would most likely be at best in a vegetative state. And the family decided that when his kidneys started to fail, and the question would have been to give him dialysis to keep him going, the family decided not to do that. And they put a do not resuscitate order into his medical record, and he died 27 days after the accident at the Brook Army Medical Center in Texas. Subsequent to that, the family filed a lawsuit against the company that one of the companies manufactured the part for the brake that they bought, and the other company that had sold it to them. And that's where it's in the records of that lawsuit that most of the details of the accident and the story of what happened are on file down in Texas.
Can you talk about the family members that you contacted and what they say about where Tom DeLay fit into this?
What they said was that, and we talked with my colleague, talked with Tom's mother, and I talked with Tom's aunt, who is both of whom were in the tram car. They said that Tom was not directly involved in all the, in everything, because he was apparently coming back and forth to Washington. But that when the decision was made, he went along with it. And he made, our understanding was that he raised no objection to that decision at that time.
I thought it was interesting in the interviews that they saw the irony.
Yes, I think there is some irony there.
Yet Tom DeLay is the person who really spearheaded this unprecedented congressional move. I mean, not just in this Congress, but in the history of the United States to intervene in this particular case. Can you talk about his role, Walter Roach?
I did not write about the legislation, but I'm familiar with it, and it is rather extraordinary, I think, for Congress to pass an act specifically targeted to a specific individual in a specific case. And if you read the legislation carefully, what it did and what people thought it promised were not exactly the same thing. It required that the courts grant a review at the federal level, but it did not guarantee that the feeding tube would be reinserted, as obviously we've learned.
Talking to Walter Roach of the Los Angeles Times, whose piece showed that 17 years ago, Tom DeLay and his own family went through this own painful, I think the operative word, though, is very personal decision not to keep Tom DeLay's father alive by external means when he had a freak accident in his backyard. We're also joined in our Washington studio by two guests. Judd Legum is director of the research at Center for American Progress, and Suzanne Goldenberg is the U.S. correspondent for the British Guardian newspaper. Can you talk, Judd, about Tom DeLay's involvement in the whole Shivos case and what the Los Angeles Times report means for that?
Well, I think Tom DeLay, without a doubt, is one of the two or three most outspoken people in Congress on this issue. And he said the very kind of thing that he himself participated in with his family 17 years ago was an act of barbarism and murder. He was that explicit about it. So I think it draws serious questions about his motivations in this case.
You were also joined by Suzanne Goldenberg of The Guardian. You wrote a very interesting piece, but it was more than a year ago, that found that Terry's father himself, Mr. Schindler, decided to turn off the life support for his own mother, who was ill with pneumonia for a week. Can you talk about that?
Yes, he did. I spent about a large part of a day with the Schindlers at their camper van, which is across the street from the hospice. And over time, he told the story of how his mother had been ill with pneumonia, and her kidneys were giving out, and he had a conversation with the doctors about what decisions needed to be made. And he asked, I've gone back to my notebook and looked at the quotes, and he asked, if I put her on a ventilator, does she have a chance of surviving, of coming out of this thing? And apparently, after discussing with the doctors, he decided his mother did not have a chance of a normal life, and so he decided to cut off the ventilator. It's not in the story, but he also told me that he wanted the decisions about his last moments, you know, if he were to suffer a catastrophic accident, that he would want those decisions to be made by his wife. And the other two members of the Schindler family, Suzanne and Bobby, were also ambivalent about what they would want to happen if they were stricken in a way similar to Terry. Both suggested to me that they did not want to be kept alive if they were, you know, in a persistent vegetative state, or to be kept alive with by artificial means.
Now, Suzanne Goldenberg, when did you conduct these interviews?
This was done in early November 2003. That was the last crisis, point of crisis, in the Terri Schiavo affair, when Governor Jeb Bush of Florida had intervened to pass a special law to reinsert the feeding tube. So at that point, there weren't all the reporters around in that area, and so I was able to sort of spend time with the family and discuss these issues with them.
And so how does this jive with their position now?
It's at odds with the position now, but you can't, I'm not sure what conclusions you can draw to motivation. I mean, it could be that Mr. Schindler feels so much remorse about the decision he made then, he's decided to keep try and keep his daughter alive at all costs. I mean, Michael Schiavo has said that he based his decision now on what to do about his wife on his own experience in dealing with his mother's death. I mean, in 1997, when they did prolong her life. I think what you can say that for these people, these were deeply personal decisions that were taken in private, and that is not the case now, of course.
We are talking to Suzanne Goldenberg, U.S. correspondent for The Guardian. We are also speaking with Jed Legum, the director of research at the Center for American Progress. Walter Roach is with the Los Angeles Times. We'll be back with Jed and Suzanne in a minute. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our Unembed the Media tour. An enormous thank you last night for the big WBAI benefit here in New York to the whole staff of Democracy Now! Who made this happen. Tonight, we'll be celebrating KPFT in Houston, Texas. Tomorrow, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and then Los Angeles, KPFK, and on Friday, celebrating KPFA in San Francisco. But we are talking right now about the politics of the Terri Schiavo case, Tom DeLay, and the expose in the Los Angeles Times that, in fact, in Tom DeLay's own family 17 years ago, his family and Tom DeLay himself made the decision to not use extraordinary means to keep his father alive. He had suffered a freak accident. We're also joined in Washington by Jed Legum, Director of Research at the Center for American Progress, and Suzanne Goldenberg, the U.S. correspondent for The Guardian. Suzanne did a piece over a year ago saying that Terri's father had, in fact, made the same decision with his own mother, not to keep her alive after a bout with pneumonia, deciding not to keep her alive through artificial means. But I wanted to start with Jed Legum on the history of Tom DeLay's role in this. Tom DeLay, who's been suffering from his own problems with ethical breaches.
Well, Tom DeLay came pretty late to the Terri Schiavo case. We did a pretty thorough search looking back at newspaper articles, his website, congressional record. And the first time Tom DeLay mentioned Terri Schiavo was on March 11th of this year. And as we've been discussing, this is a case that's been going on for several years. So I think that raises a very serious question of Tom DeLay's motivations in this, and was it motivated by a concern for what the Schindlers are going through, what Terri Schiavo is going through, which is obviously a very tragic situation, or was it a more calculated maneuver to distract attention from the various ethical problems that he's been having over the past months and years?
There's also another irony in the case of Tom DeLay's own family in making this decision to allow his father to die. And that has to do with the issue of bringing a lawsuit against the company involved with this freak accident.
That's right. Right after this accident occurred and they made the decision to remove life support, Tom DeLay and his family sued the manufacturer of a bearing ball company that was actually involved in the manufacturing of this lift that caused the accident of Tom DeLay's father. And they sued them on a product liability lawsuit. They settled it for a fairly substantial sum, around $250,000. And Tom DeLay, although he says he gave the money to his mother, personally profited from this. And what's really interesting about that is just 3 years later, Tom DeLay introduced a bill into Congress which would have trumped the very kind of state laws that his family sued this company under and made this substantial recovery under.
The New York Times reported on Sunday, and this is going to a different issue, that the Pentagon is considering substantial changes to the military tribunals that the Bush administration established to prosecute who they call foreign terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay. The move comes after intense criticism from human rights groups and military attorneys. You have written about this as well on the American Progress website.
That's right. And the situation that's going on there is not only has it been subject to criticism, which is certainly one thing that's concerning, but it's also been ruled, these tribunals have been ruled unconstitutional by a federal judge. And so there is, and this is a positive development, a movement within the Department of Defense to reform these procedures and to bring them more in the line with the standard court-martial proceedings and there's really the American judicial system and the protections that we traditionally afford defendants. But Vice President Cheney is leading a small group of people who are very much opposed to any changes unless they're absolutely mandated to do so by the courts.
Suzanne Goldenberg, you have been covering U.S. politics and also the invasion and occupation of Iraq for the Guardian newspaper in Britain. You wrote a piece on International Women's Day, actually, on March 8th, about the soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Brigade, the same military unit whose troops fired on the car carrying the freed Italian hostage, Giuliana Sugrena, saying that they were under investigation last year for raping Iraqi women. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, there's the incident involved a group of soldiers who were guarding something resembling a strip mall in Iraq and that they were found to have had sex with, I think, two Iraqi women who were there. This incident was investigated by the army. But it did not reach any conclusions about as to whether the women were raped or not, in part because investigators did not find or question the women involved. And this is one of those episodes that has come to light only because of action taken by the ACLU, which has been filing Freedom of Information requests to try and get copies of these investigations. And in the view of the ACLU, this shows that the investigative procedures both for all kinds of war crimes, whether it's killings or beating detention or indeed rape, these investigations have not been very thorough, and therefore it's not that surprising when they don't turn up any evidence of wrongdoing.
You also quote Jamil Jafar, an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union, which has led a long legal struggle to get the Pentagon to release the documents of its investigations, arguing that the failure to conduct a thorough investigation on such serious charges as rape is part of a disturbing pattern. And you quote him saying, there are always questions in these files about whether the investigator was sufficiently aggressive in pursuing leads and tracking down evidence. In the documents that the ACLU obtained, one soldier told investigators, I know the women were Iraqi. I, however, don't know if they were raped or were prostitutes or just wanted sex.
That's true. And as I said, the investigators did not locate the women. They did not question the women. When you read through these files, which essentially are transcripts of interviews that the investigating officers held with soldiers who were or officers who were there, you notice that the soldiers will sort of respond in the negative, and there will not be follow-up questions. Their statements will not be challenged. The interviews are not very rigorous, and that's a pattern that has become evident in the large amounts of documents that have been obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union. That's like hundreds, or actually thousands, of pages of documents.
Interestingly, yesterday on Democracy Now!, we were joined by Camilo Mejia, who is the Florida Army National Guardsman who fought in Iraq for about half a year, came back to the United States on leave, and then refused to return, saying he did not want to participate in the abuse of Iraqis, among other issues. He was the first soldier court-martialed for refusing to turn to Iraq, and he's just come out of jail. In light of that, it's very interesting that you write about an officer believed to have destroyed a homemade DVD showing members of the Florida National Guard abusing Iraqi detainees and manipulating the hand of a dead Iraqi to wave at the camera. Another scene shows a soldier hitting a bound prisoner on the head with a rifle butt. At least one of the soldiers, a sergeant, was identified from the DVD. However, no criminal charges were brought in that investigation after military lawyers concluded the DVD showed inappropriate rather than criminal behavior. This DVD, the soldiers called Ramadi Madness, was found where?
I believe it was found, it's a few weeks ago now, but I believe it was found just in the desk of an officer or during an office, during a cleanup or something like that. It was, back in Florida, and it was then sent on to the authorities. But I'm sorry, my memory of the details is sketchy.
Well, you write that, and also say that the DVD was later destroyed by an officer who'd learned that the case was under investigation, leading the ACLU to saying there is this layer of abuse that we're not seeing because the evidence is being destroyed.
And that's correct. And I think that we've now seen at least two cases in which DVDs have been destroyed, both the Ramadi Madness one that you've talked about, and I think there's been DVDs of abuses or alleged abuse in Afghanistan. And that documentation has also been destroyed with the express purpose of thwarting an investigation.
Suzanne Goldenberg, you live here, you report here, but you're reporting for a foreign newspaper. You're reporting for The Guardian. How much weight, since you also read American papers, how much more weight, or is it more weight, do British papers give to these issues of abuse as opposed to here in the United States, how much attention is paid to it?
I think we probably give as much attention as the sort of larger American papers like the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post. Where we differ, and I think where we've given a lot more weight recently, is where we cover the sort of anti-war movement. We covered the case of Camilo Mejia. We went to his trial. We've written about other conscientious objectors. Kevin Benderman, for example, in Fort Stewart, I think will be the next high-profile case to come up. So we've covered those movements much more thoroughly than the American press. We've also had more full-scale investigations, not just in Iraq, but we've had sort of a couple landmark investigations into abuses in Guantanamo and to abuses in Bagram, Afghanistan, and that has not been matched by the big American papers, although their daily coverage is similar to what we do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Suzanne Goldenberg, U.S. correspondent for The Guardian newspaper, and Judd Legum, director of research at the Center for American Progress, both joining us from Washington, D.C., where we'll be broadcasting from on Thursday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to President Bush's poll ratings, he's reached an all-time low in his presidency. He's made two major miscalculations, according to the polls, in the last month. One, his involvement with the Schiavo case, where it turns out the overwhelming majority of people are opposed to congressional intervention, which President Bush approved, flying back in the middle of the night from his vacation in Crawford to sign off on congressional legislation. Add to that Social Security and his ill-fated 60-city tour, his ratings are at an all-time low. The Schiavo case was clearly a serious miscalculation for Bush, and the majority of Americans don't buy his Social Security privatization plan. A Washington Post ABC News poll found that 55% of Americans oppose his plan. Recently in New York, a debate was held at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. It was called Social Security: Is It Really a Crisis? It featured New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century, as well as Josh Micah Marshall, who runs the website talkingpointsmemo.com. It began with Michael Tanner from the Cato Institute. Under his direction, Cato's launched the Project on Social Security Choice, advocating privatizing Social Security.
Social Security debate is clearly one of the most important public policy issues to face our country in a long time. And I think we have reached the point in this debate where any reasonable person understands that Social Security reform is not an option, but a necessity. The simple facts are these. In less than 15 years, Social Security will begin to run a deficit. That is, spending more money on benefits than it takes in revenue. Overall, Social Security is facing unfunded obligations of close to $12 trillion. That's trillion with a T, and that's real money even in Washington. Now, we can have semantic debates forever about whether or not this constitutes a crisis or simply a big problem, and we'll probably hear such a debate tonight. But I would like to suggest that that is not what we're really talking about, neither a crisis nor a problem, but rather an opportunity to create a new and a better retirement program for America's future, a program that would give America's workers ownership and control over their money. I think most people don't understand that under the current Social Security system, you have no legal, property, or contractual right to your benefits whatsoever. The Supreme Court ruled in a case called Fleming versus Nestor that Social Security taxes are simply a tax like all other taxes, and the benefits provided by the Social Security system are simply a government spending program like all government spending programs, and that there is no connection whatsoever between the two. Congress is free to change your benefits, reduce them, or take them away. And in fact, Social Security turns us all into supplicants, that if we work hard, play by the rules, pay our taxes, then when we get to be age 65 or 67, we can go hat in hand to 535 politicians in Washington and ask them to give us some money to retire on. And we're asking them to do this in a system that is nearly $12 trillion in debt. This is a system under which workers, because they have no ownership of their money, if they die prematurely, they cannot pass that money on to their heirs. So think of the single mother working maybe two jobs to try to make ends meet, paying 12.5% of her income in Social Security taxes, and at age 59 or 60, she dies. And her children are over the age of 18, so they're not eligible for survivor's benefits. What happens to all the money that she's paid in to Social Security over the course of her lifetime? It's simply gone, lost. None of that money is passed on to her children that they could use to go to college or start a small business. We have a system today in which middle and low-income people cannot accumulate a nest egg of real inheritable wealth. But we have a proposal now before us which would change Social Security and make it a better system, a system in which workers own and control their money, in which their benefits are not at the whims of politicians, and which no politician can ever take away. That's the stark choice that we face when we talk about Social Security reform, because if all we care about is solvency, I'm sure we can raise taxes yet again, as we've done some 40 times since the program began, or we can cut benefits yet again, as we've done repeatedly, and we can make young people pay more and get less. But if we really care about our children and our grandchildren, and we really want a better future for all working Americans, then we should give workers ownership and control over their money, because it is their money, not the government's, and it belongs to them, and it should belong to them now and in the future.
Michael Tanner of the Cato Institute in a debate at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. When we come back, Paul Krugman of the New York Times responds, followed by Josh Marshall. This is Democracy Now. Be back in a minute.
Could be my president, and really I don't care. They say Cheney make my decision, but he don't, so I'm just not there. I'm gonna see the same lies when they are coming in of the next 4 years. So pardon me if I don't cry when your election go the way. In a time of war, some peace in a time of war, some peace in a time of war, some peace in a time of political war. They say that we elect the leader to lead forward and make decisions, but I never read the policy and war discussed during an election. Seen that war is something over which people have no prevention, but the people want it anyway, and so they elect some destruction. I need peace in a time of war. Yeah, some peace in a time of war.
Peace in a Time of War, Soldiers of Jah Army, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report has returned to the debate at the New York Society for Ethical Culture around Social Security. After Michael Tanner of the Cato Institute spoke, Paul Krugman followed, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, columnist for the New York Times, author of 20 books, including The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Paul Krugman.
Let me just first say what Social Security is, and just to repeat. It is not a pension fund. It is not an investment project. It's a social insurance program. It's something that is there to protect people against misfortune. Now, it's a big social insurance program. It is, in fact, the principal source of retirement income for many, many people in the United States. But you need to think of it always as, in fact, being social insurance. Now, it fulfills that function very well. Michael Tanner talks about the 59-year-old person whose children are adult, who receives nothing if she passes away, and this is true. There's a reason for that, which is those are children who are working age. They can take care of themselves. We might like them to have more, but this is not what the program is for. Think instead about the 35-year-old working man with a traditional family. Wife hasn't worked, hasn't paid into the system. Several, maybe many children, is hit by a bus. Social Security provides a lot of benefits for that person. It provides a lot of insurance for the kind of person who is really in need. Or, worse yet, the 35-year-old working man who is not killed but hurt. And Social Security is a disability program. It's worth pointing out, survivors and disability benefits are very crucial. And no program that is basically about accumulating wealth for yourself is going to provide the survivors and disability benefits. And by the way, we do not have a clear explanation of what will happen to those. One of the important things to point out is that there is no plan. At least there is no public plan. We have not been given any details. We're sort of trying to guess. The president says he won't negotiate with himself. It makes you wonder why there's a demand that the Democrats produce a plan when the administration won't tell us what its plan is. Second thing to say, Social Security's funding. What is the scale of the problem? Well, now this is a social insurance program that is paid for by a dedicated tax. There are a certain number of government programs, the Highway Trust Fund. The highways are paid for by specific dedicated revenues. There are always two ways to think about that. One is you can think about it as a standalone project, in which case there is a problem, crisis, whatever you want to call it, if the dedicated tax is not bringing in enough to pay for the program. And the other is you can just think of it as part of the federal budget as a whole and say, look, it's all part of the same thing. Both views have some meaning. As long as Social Security by itself is taking in enough money and has enough money in the trust fund, then there is no action-forcing event. Then you don't have to do anything to keep it going. And if we look at that, well, we say Social Security, on the very conservative estimates of the Social Security Administration, is good till 2042 on that basis. By the Congressional Budget Office says 10 years more. The point is, the program in itself is not, there is a problem, perhaps a long-term problem in the funding, but it's not particularly large. And on the scale of things, let's just remember that if we believe the Social Security Administration's rather downbeat forecast, in 2042, the Social Security, the payroll tax will be taking in only 73 cents for every dollar of promised benefits. Right now, the federal government, actually fiscal 2004, the federal government outside of Social Security was taking in 68 cents of revenue for every dollar of spending. So I don't think we can get really upset about the notion that, you get the point. I guess I don't have to finish that sentence. There's also, the broader issue, of course, is, well, you know, but this is, of course, the trust fund is a claim by one part of the government on the rest. And there can be a problem, you know, even if Social Security has money in the trust fund, if the federal government as a whole is bankrupt, then we have a problem. We have a fiscal crisis. But that doesn't make any sense to call it a Social Security crisis. In fact, if your view is it's just a federal budget, then it's just the federal budget. We don't talk about the deficit of the Defense Department. It's just part of the whole thing. We are very much at risk of having a fiscal crisis, but the rising payments to retirees is a small piece of the reasons to be concerned. But it's a small piece. It's dominated by, first of all, the deficit we're running right now, which has nothing to do with Social Security. Secondly, by the problem of medical costs, and that's a whole different debate, where I think that we are probably ideologically incapable of talking about a sensible solution. And retirement is a really, really distant third in that whole issue. So it's just as no Social Security crisis. Now, just the last thing to say here, I think, is that this is not a debate about the solvency of the program. In fact, I'm rather relieved. Michael Tanner has given a talk that allows us to have a more intelligent discussion than we might otherwise have. The whole crisis, if the system is unsustainable, disaster thing, is all, aside from being, I think, wrong, is also it's a bait and switch operation in terms of this discussion. Because the issue on the table, which is whether we're going to privatize this thing, has nothing to do with solvency. It's all about, are we going to convert this from a system of social insurance to a system which is really just a big 401k, which has a lot of problems along the way, we may get into those. But this is really a debate about whether you want to eliminate the role of government as providing a sort of basic level of retirement income, basic level of disability benefits, basic level of survivor benefits. I think there's a reason why that's not the way it's usually phrased, because if you put it that way, the fact is the public will say no. We'll say no to the change. We'll say that this system has worked, that they do not want to change it to something different, which is, I think, what we're finding right now. But in any case, the point is, let's talk about what the real issue is. Let's talk about, as our moderator said, let's talk about what kind of society we want to be. Thanks.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. The final speaker in the Social Security debate was Josh Micah Marshall, contributing writer for the Washington Monthly, a columnist for The Hill, and runs a website called TalkingPointsMemo.com. This is Josh Marshall.
Is what happened? The president was just reelected. He has expanded majorities in both houses of Congress. Michael's former colleagues are hived in all over the executive branch and the Social Security Administration and at the White House. And Paul is a voice crying out in the wilderness on the New York Times op-ed page. So what happened? We heard about this political capital, and yet if you look at where this debate is right now, Social Security privatization isn't dead, but it is, because it's really not dead until the president says it's dead, but it's about as close as it could be without being dead. So what happened? And why did the White House go down this path if it is faring so poorly? I think the first thing that happened is that the Karl Rove and President Bush allowed the thing to happen that is most dangerous in politics, which is you fall for your own spin. And over the years, I think that many Republicans, and President Bush particularly, decided that this was a popular reform. And the way they did that was by doing basically what Michael just did. Put the best case forward for what you get. You have ownership. You can pass. Equity you build up to your heirs and so forth. Michael never mentioned benefit cuts in your guaranteed benefits. And when you say that, support for the whole thing drops rapidly. I think what happened is basically the White House really fooled themselves into thinking this would be far easier than indeed it would be. They still knew they would have to rush it through, but they basically, that's the first thing. The second thing is, and Democrats did this very quickly, is their party unity took away all the political cover and was really going to be up to Republicans to make privatization an entirely Republican enterprise. And they were too afraid to do it because a lot of those representatives could see how their constituents were going to react and so forth. And the final problem they hit or misapprehension they had is that the White House's political interests in this debate are very different from the congressional Republicans' political interests in this debate. And here's what I mean. President Bush isn't running for office again, obviously. If he can... One second, man. If he can do this, if he can pass Social Security privatization, that will make him a... If not in the evaluative sense, in the descriptive sense, one of the great presidents in terms of influence, in terms of the effect that he has had on this country, if he were able to do this. So for him, for the White House, the stakes, the upside of success in Social Security privatization, in terms of the conservative movement, conservative ideology, and so forth, and just ego, the Bush presidency, the upsides are boundless. The downside is also almost bottomless, but high stakes on both sides. For Democrats, similar. Everything's on the line for ideological reasons for Democrats. On the other hand, if they can stop him in his tracks, it's very good for them. The problem is, and I think this is another problem the White House didn't figure on, is that the stakes are very different for the congressional Republicans. And for them, it's basically like this. They have a good thing going. They have majorities in both houses of Congress. They have a money machine built up that makes it very hard to displace those majorities. If the president succeeds with privatization, you know, that's fine. It's great. You know, they're into it at some level of political belief. But it's not going to really change the good thing that they have going politically. If it goes badly, they could lose everything. And so you have, again, a situation where the two primary opponents here, the Democrats and the White House, very high stakes gambit on both sides. The group that the White House needs to carry the water for it, to vote for this, to actually make it happen, nothing to gain and tons to lose. And I think those three things together have really brought it to the point that we're at now. Paul made the point, people like this program. I think in this audience, I probably would get a lot of hands if I said, you know, who likes the Social Security program? But I think I could go all across the United States. And as long as I wasn't at a Federalist Society meeting or something like that, I would get the same thing. And that's really what it comes down to. This isn't a popular reform when it's explained in a complete and straightforward way. And that's why it's, at the moment at least, on life support.
Josh Micah Marshall, contributing writer for The Hill and as well The Washington Monthly, and he runs a website called talkingpointsmemo.com. He was following Paul Krugman and Michael Tanner debating Social Security at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Special thanks to Leslie Doyle. As we wrap up our broadcast today and begin on our Unembed the Media tour, we head off today to Houston tonight to celebrate KPFT, then fly to Washington, D.C. tomorrow, where we'll be celebrating WPFW at All Souls Unitarian Church on Harvard Street, a reception before at Mimi's American Bistro. You can call WPFW for details. On Thursday, we'll be in Los Angeles with the brother of Jose Coso, the Spanish journalist killed at the Palestine Hotel when U.S. troops opened fire. Javier Coso, on our broadcast last week, is calling for an independent investigation of the shelling of the Palestine Hotel. The event will be taking place in Los Angeles at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church with a reception before. You can call KPFK for details. On Friday, April 1st, we will be celebrating KPFA in San Francisco. We'll be joined by Devorah Major and Javier Coso, brother of Jose, at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater on Lion Street in San Francisco. Call KPFA for details. And then on Saturday at the Baghdad Theater in Portland, Oregon at 1 o'clock for our event there. And in the evening in Seattle, all the news that's fit to own, who controls the media, and why we should care. Be joined by Phil Donahue as well. That's Seattle in the evening. And on Sunday morning, we'll be celebrating KBCS in Seattle as well. You can go to the KBCS website for more details. Want to thank an amazing team of people. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Thanks also to Uri Galed and Angela Alston, Orlando Richards, John Randolph, Chris Zucker. As well, want to thank Karen Renucci and Dennis Moynihan, Isis Phillips and Neil Shabato, Ting Ting Cheng and Tamiko Beyer, Susie Salami and Danielle Ferris, Jenny Falapazzo, Angie Karen, Dave Rice, Mike Castleman, and all the people who make Democracy Now! Happen around this country and around the world, the volunteers that make this broadcast happen. For information on the Unembed the Media tour, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. You can also sign up there for our daily digest, where you can get daily headlines and media alerts. And you can email events as we go through the country to your friends and let them know where we'll be. Next Monday, we'll be in Philadelphia, then head to Sarasota, Florida. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.